So we're making our way through this course, Healing Anxiety and Depression. It's usually a six-week course, but we've had a couple of extra weeks, which is great because it gives us a bit of time to go through the worksheets and do some meditations, which is what we did last week. So as you know, the course is based on Buddhist psychology, so you don't need to be Buddhist or even religious to be able to benefit, because just based on the Buddha's really fine understanding of the mind, how the mind works, how our psychology works. So what we've covered so far, the how the big context, the nature of our mind, our very nature from a Buddhist point of view is seen as being good, fundamentally pure, not fundamentally broken, but fundamentally pure, clean and clear. That's the actual nature of our mind. But how can we experience confusion and unhappiness and distress and all the roiling, disturbing emotions is because we make mistakes about things and we grasp at a nature that isn't there. We can't see the one that is there. So everything goes wrong. We are overwhelmed by the toxicity of our disturbing emotions. And as we know, once a disturbing emotion comes up, then all the other ones come up along with it, and then we act badly, and then all the results come with that, and then we act even worse. So, you know, it's this domino effect. But it's really important to remember this nature of our mind, just like the sky. The nature of the sky is clear. There can be a huge amount of toxic pollution in the sky, but it doesn't break the fundamental nature of the sky. It does have an effect, but that effect can be changed. It can be purified. So we're dominated by the inner terrorists, which are all of the disturbing emotions and our hopes and our fears and our anxieties and our guilts and all sorts of things. And so we had this analogy of our mind being like a vast international airport that is teeming with people arriving and people going. And our job is to figure out who the terrorists are. And as we know, a terrorist isn't just the cliche of what a terrorist looks like. If it was easy like that, it'd be great. But a lot of our inner terrorists, which are far worse than any external terrorists, are disguised that when the disturbing emotions first arise, they feel good. They feel like they're going to help us, like we need them. And yet it backfires so terribly. And so our job, we're like the poor little inner security guard at the airport or at the mall. So, you know, if you've ever seen this movie, I think it's Mall Guy or something or other. So helps on the way, but until then there's Paul Blart. So that's kind of, when I saw this poor security guy at the mall, you know, I just thought that's how I am trying to do my meditation, you know. I'm trying to focus or concentrate or figure things out and I'm just like hopeless. So we're all a little bit like that, the mall cop, a little bit under the sway of the disturbing emotions. But we really have to stop them before they do terrible damage. We've looked at cognitive fusion. I'll just get rid of those. And we'll have a more closer look at that again today. Cognitive fusion, remember, is when something feels bad, we think it is bad. And so a lot of the emotions that arise, because they feel bad, we think they are bad for us, that there's no use and that we just have to get rid of them. Just because something feels bad, it can be a fleeting sensation, and actually those things could be quite beneficial for us. So, for instance, if you've eaten something that's poisonous or rotten and you start feeling sick and think, oh, no, I think I'm going to chuck, like no one likes that feeling, but it keeps us alive, doesn't it? Because we expel the poison and then don't we feel better afterwards? So not pleasant, but important. So cognitive fusion goes, oh, not pleasant, let's not do it. So if you've ever felt like you're going to chuck and go, no, 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 don't, which I've done many times after drinking way too much alcohol, then, of course, the poison just stays in your system. And that's far worse. That's actually what does the damage. So this is what we do with the emotions. Emotions, feelings, emotional sensations, disturbing emotions all arise in our mind, and because they feel bad, we try and make them stop, which isn't necessarily good for us. So what we looked at a couple of weeks ago was how to listen to the kernel of wisdom in anxiety, because anxiety is one of those things. It can turn into a habit of worry and get away with us. But again, because anxiety feels bad, we just want to get rid of it. But anxiety actually is our wisdom trying to get our attention where we're not placing our attention at the moment. And if we can't listen to what our anxiety can show us, it will keep coming back. So, of course, when we have any feelings like that of anxiety or worry, at first we think it's bad and we just want to get rid of it. But if we can just take a little moment and not panic and then actually investigate what's the deeper meaning here, then we'll be able to get to the root of it, and then we'll actually be able to stop it. So anxiety, in a way, or worry, can be our best friend. So I was thinking the other day, Jinx, so, you know, talk about being an engineer. Now, I'm really glad that you worry as an engineer, because that makes me feel safe in buildings. I want the people who devise the public transport system to worry about it. That makes me feel safe. So not pleasant, but really important, you know. So anxiety, no doubt, has had to become a skill for you, right, that you can use it without it making you insane or you'd have to quit your job. So did you have anything that you use, Jinx, to keep that balance in your mind? Right, so when you do think about it, kind of pick your times, okay? Yeah, because any kind of worry that we do in the middle of the night turns into catastrophizing. Yep. Verbalize it, write it down. So you capture it, but yeah, that's right. It forces us to become clear and actually pinpoint what the worry is. So that's a way of using that kind of inner discipline for your wisdom to arise. Yeah, and get to it. Yeah.
I recognize it in the
sick. Oh, yes. Yeah. So even then, that gives you some space. So if you notice that you worry much more just as the momentum of worry in the evening, then go, yes, that might be very important, but I'm going to think about it tomorrow when I'm all fresh. And then do you look at it the next day, or when you're so optimistic, you go, oh, no, she'll be right. Oh, no. No, what we want to do is when we're feeling optimistic and have that thought, it'll all be fine, that's when we start looking at the things, because we need to look at those worrisome things with a relaxed mind. Yeah. And so just a little bit, you know, over your nice cup of tea or coffee or something, with that sense of optimism, look at the situation. Because how we analyze things from a sense of optimism is really different from a sense of catastrophe at the end of the night when we're really tired. So the other thing I was just reading the other day, that if you ever go to court, you know, if you have a court case, you want your case to come up in the morning or straight after lunch. Not before lunch. People whose court cases get decided before lunch, when everyone's hungry and just want to get out of there, have a far worse sentence. Yeah. So how we feel about things, you know, it's very sensitive, isn't it? But we're not very aware of it. Okay. So what we'll have a look at today is the anger side of things. So, you know, the last couple of weeks we've been looking at the attachment side of things, and the catastrophic result of attachment being anxiety. So the flip side of attachment, is what we kind of colloquially couldn't think of as anger, because anger is what happens when attachment doesn't get what it wants. So it's kind of part two of the story. So we're going to actually unpick what anger is, the difference, say, between anger and hatred and frustration, the drawbacks, recognizing how it really harms us, even when we feel we're justified, and then how to stay calm in difficult situations. So there are three types of patience that we can learn how to practice, because up until I was studying this kind of stuff, I just thought when people said be patient, it just meant gritting your teeth and going patient, patient, patient. And of course, that's not being patient. That's being really uptight and squeezing your mind and trying to force yourself to not retaliate. But that's not patience. So patience is actually being able to keep your mind calm in the face of difficulty, not just in the face of anger, but in the face of problems, in the face of when things go wrong, how to keep your mind on an even keel. So it's such a, the patience is the antidote to just about every single problem in life, not just anger, but it's the direct, antidote for anger. So we'll have a look at what those three types of patience are. But let's start with setting our motivation, shall we? So take a nice deep breath and let out any stale air in the lungs so that you can naturally let your breathing become a bit slower, a bit deeper. At least notice if you are breathing just from that top part of the lungs, that you let your whole chest and heart area relax. Imagine a fine thread of light running from the base of your spine up through your body, coming out the crown of your head, and as if you're just being gently pulled up from your crown. Feel the weight of your body suspended, your posture naturally become aligned, your spine straighter, posture more alert, but still relaxed. And once your spine is relatively straight, then release any tension from the shoulders. Let your shoulders drop. With every out-breath, feel the tension flow down the neck and the shoulders and off the tips of the shoulders. And feel that nice balance between having a straight spine and having a relaxed body. And gently bring your focus to the breath. So you're bringing your focus inwards, just becoming aware of the rolling rhythm of your breath. Feel the breath coming in and out from the nostrils. If your mind is very busy, you can just say in and out as you're breathing. And so the thing is to not try and make any thoughts or distractions go away. The thing is to not get involved in them when they arise. To just keep your focus on the breath. And any distraction, if you do get carried away, try and notice as soon as possible. And don't berate yourself. Don't succumb to whatever the thought or the feeling is, just notice and name. Notice that it happened, that you got distracted. Name it, a thought or a feeling or a memory, and then bring your focus back to the breath. And as you're letting your focus rest on the breath, you'll become aware of the inner environment of your mind tonight. So again, without judging it as good or bad, just noticing if the mind is busy or if the mind is calm. Recognizing that you're not reducible to any one thought or feeling. And that all of these experiences arise in that infinite spaciousness of the mind. And we can take a moment to adjust our motivation. So whatever the main purpose for coming here tonight, bring that to mind. Might be something quite personal, or might be something going on at the moment. It might be an ongoing issue. It might be something to do with others. Maybe somebody else close to you is going through difficulty. So starting with our own personal purpose and recognizing that we're here tonight not just to put a band-aid on the problem, but really investigate what the problem is and be able to put an end not just to suffering, but the very causes of suffering. And then we can also extend our motivation to include the benefit of others, that we certainly are not alone, and we're not alone in our problems or our suffering. And that everything that happens to us, we can use to benefit ourselves and to be able to benefit others, to help others, to at least share their pain, to develop our empathy, but also to be able to help others out of suffering completely and into a state of lasting peace and happiness, that this is possible if we continue developing our good qualities and investigating the nature of our mind. So with this very vast, big motivation that includes our benefit and the benefit of everybody else, because we can. So then another deep breath in through the nose, out through the mouth, bring your focus back to the room. And let's have a look at, well, anger. One of the things that arises to completely destroy our equilibrium, our joie de vivre. Anger is like, holding on to anger is like grasping a hot coal with the intent of throwing it at someone else. You are the one who gets burned. So even though to me this is really obvious, I still have to keep coming back to it again and again, because especially when I feel I'm right and they're wrong, I just want to hold on to that hot coal. And so of course we bring untold suffering onto ourselves, and then it also we also retaliate onto others. So probably this one, you could definitely say this about hatred, but we'll, in a moment, we'll have a look what the actual definition of anger is from a Buddhist point of view. But pretty much from the point of view, you know, we look at anger, this incredibly destructive force, the only function that it has is to make us unhappy. The other thing to recognize is if being angry worked, we would all be liberated by now, right? If it worked, it would already have worked, for sure. If we just squish our anger down or bite our tongue, It doesn't actually stop the anger. It just stops us expressing it. And if we can't work with it, it turns into depression. It kind of implodes inward and turns into depression. So we really have to work with it. If we don't work with it, we also lose a huge amount of energy. And that's why we become depressed, because we suppress it. It looks like I have a huge amount of reading for you, but I just got a little bit from each of these books. So a little story from Venerable Gatso from The Perfect Mirror. In the chapter of anger, I once read that after a domestic argument, an angry husband rented a bulldozer and reduced his family home to rubble. Can you imagine what was going through his mind? And can you imagine how he felt when he calmed down and realized the folly of his actions? Anger is the most destructive force in the universe. It destroys our inner peace, and it causes us to inflict irrational verbal and physical abuse upon our family and friends, to destroy our possessions, and even to destroy our own bodies through excessive drinking, smoking, reckless behavior, or suicide. Anger makes even the most handsome face look ugly. It harms our physical health, and it leads to isolation and loneliness because nobody can bear to be near us anymore. Buddha taught that the worst effect of anger is not even immediately obvious. Anger destroys our accumulated virtue, thus preventing any chance of future happiness. So this is probably one of the first things to recognize, is that anger actually harms us. It's guaranteed to harm us. It's not guaranteed to harm the person that we're angry at. If we have anger plus hostility, anger plus indifference, or hostility plus indifference, that really is the most destructive force in the world. Because not only is there the force of anger, but if we have indifference, which pretty much we have to everybody that we don't know, which is the majority of living beings, then there's nothing holding us back from retaliating. So if you're driving along and you get road rage and you start yelling at the person in front of you, there's the hostility and there's indifference because you don't know that person. Now, if you actually overtake them and you look in the window and you see it's your grandma or your sister, oh my God, wouldn't you feel mortified? So it's that thing of, if you actually care about the person, so you've overcome the indifference, that is actually what holds us back from harming them. So anger, the broad kind of definition, anger, hatred, hostility, aggression, and it comes from a feeling of I don't like it, which actually is quite an innocuous feeling, I don't like it. It's just a dissatisfied mind, an unhappy mind. But all the other emotions come from it. Belligerence, resentment, spite, thoughts of revenge. I mean, we know all these so well, don't we? Well, at least I do. You may not, but I do. And not only that, but then I know them from the movies as well. So I suppose one of the only good things about anger is that it is easy to recognize. We know when we're angry. Whereas like in the previous classes, when we looked at, say, pride, issues of identity, we don't know if we have pride. Other people can tell we're proud, but we have no idea. Attachment, we don't know we've got attachment whilst we're still anticipating things. We think everything's great. But if we're anticipating and then we don't get the thing, now suddenly we're annoyed. So we know we're annoyed, but did we notice that we were overcome by attachment, craving, dissatisfaction the whole rest of the time? No, it was invisible to us. So at least we can recognize anger. The other thing is that luckily we're not angry all the time. So you're all sitting here, clearly not angry. If you were angry, you'd be getting up and going. So we have a respite from anger, which gives us a little moment to be able to prepare and do something about it before it explodes. We don't necessarily have to learn how to be angry. It's something that we are very familiar with. And it almost feels like it's us, but it's not. It comes from a distortion, a disturbing mind, distorted mind. Yes. Yep. Yeah, dissatisfied. So that's probably not full-blown anger yet, in that it's not aggressive or it's not hostile or retaliatory, because there is a spectrum. There's a big spectrum. But that's a good point, actually, for when we're just generally unhappy, sulky, what's frustrated, annoyed, all of those things. They're all next door to full-blown anger. And so it's really important if we can recognize that. But normally when someone says, what are you angry about, what do we do then? I very am not. So it's not part of our nature. It's part of our confusion. This is the thing. And in Western psychology will say, oh, it's just instinctual. It's just part of your nature. That's just a belief. There's no substantiated evidence for that. In fact, where there's substantiated evidence is looking after others is part of our nature. It's when we feel threatened that and where things go wrong that the anger and hostility and defensiveness comes up. But actually deeper than that is natural care and concern for others. So this has been borne out, say, with wild animals. When wild animals are cared for and fed and they don't have to go and actually hunt and kill other animals, ones that are natural enemies can live together peacefully. So, you know, you take away the hostile environment, what naturally comes up isn't the animals killing each other. What naturally comes up is making friends. So, you know, that's the proof that deeper than anger and hostility is this natural care and a kind of affinity with others. Okay, so how anger harms us? Well, one of the things is we look ugly or terrifying. And you might think this is obvious when other people are angry, yes, but what about with us? We never think we look ugly or terrifying. You know, we turn red, we sweat, we splutter. If you've ever had an angry teacher at school or an angry boss, like, you know, that's how we remember them as well, isn't it? It is us who suffers, guaranteed. In fact, not only they may not suffer, but they may laugh at us if we get angry. There's another fantastic saying about this, you know, with us who suffers, holding a grudge is like letting your worst enemy live rent-free in your head. You know, you can't enjoy anything. Anger prevents us from enjoying even the things that we love. Nice food, movies, it creates such an inner toxicity. Also, when we have anger, we can't learn from mistakes. We lose the benefit from making mistakes. So we lose any benefit from constructive criticism. We, coupled with pride, then we can't even ask for help. We just get so defensive. There may even be people there helping us, but we're like, no, shut up. I can do it. And if someone tries to help us, we hear it as an insult. If we have an angry mind, what happens? We stuff up, someone tries to help us. What do we hear? This new term that I learned the other day, implied criticism. Someone helps us, we hear it as criticism. Why? Because of the mind of anger. So we lose any benefit from being able to actually fix things, develop. We destroy our property, we smash our stuff, we fall into disrepute, people fear us, people remember us for being angry. So, you know, I might have been told you off and on about how back in the day before I came to Langley Thomas Centre, I drank way too much vodka. So as kind of a form of self-medication. And one of the main reasons I stopped drinking vodka was because I went from being decades-long happy drunk to suddenly it became toxic in my system and I became a belligerent drunk. And I scared myself. I turned into one of those scary, angry drunks. And I can remember being on Brunswick Street, Fitzroy, ripping a municipal rubbish bin off its post and throwing it at the windscreen of a passing car. And whilst I was doing that, going, oh my God, I'm one of those people. No. And that was a bit of a wake-up call for me. So that's what happens. If you let it run its course, it just gets worse. It becomes more and more toxic. So you fall into disrepute. You lose your friends and family. You harm them or you even kill them, kill those close to you. Don't we know with so much domestic abuse and violence, how does this happen? And it happens because we don't know how to deal with anger or when things go wrong, and it prevents our future happiness. So there's this fantastic book called Change of Heart, The Bodhisattva Peace Training. It's really good in terms of very practical stuff to do with how to deal with anger. And each chapter has these really interesting questions at the end from Westerners to this Buddhist teacher. So this is what he says. The truth is that we can rarely force others to act as we think they should, or deter them from doing the things we don't like. No matter how much we may want them to, it's unlikely others will act according to our wishes. And we can seldom prevent difficulties from arising. We need to realize that our habitual approach to challenges, trying to change everything and everyone else, is ineffective. It fails to address the root of the problem, which is the negativity within our own mind. Trying to change the world without changing our mind is like trying to clean the dirty face we see in the mirror by scrubbing the glass. However vigorously we clean it, our reflection will not improve. Only by washing our own face and combing our own unkempt hair can we alter the image. Similarly, if we want to help create conditions that foster peace and well-being in the world, we first need to reflect these qualities ourselves. So it's quite a different approach rather than, well, I'm angry because everyone else is just acting badly, so why don't they all, you know, get it together? They won't. What we can do is work on our own mind. So one of the first things that we can do is whenever we feel anger arising, to recognize that this is going to harm me. This feeling is going to harm me. It's like an inner cancer eating away at my well-being and equilibrium. Because anger is as addictive as attachment. We kind of fall under its spell. So here's a definition of anger. And, you know, continuing on with our most wanted posters, Angry Andy. Hope there's no one in the room here called Andy. It's always a bit of a toss-up, isn't it? Anyway, so funnily enough, when I found the photos for this pirate fellow, it looks just like my ex-husband, who I actually feel very warm towards. But, yes. The marauding pirate. So the reason why I've depicted anger as a pirate is, did anyone here love pirates as a kid? Dress up as pirates? Talk like a pirate day? Yeah? Okay, good, good. So the whole thing about pirates, on one hand, in the little ecosystem of pirates, it's a very egalitarian society. Everybody's there on the ship. If you fall over, you know, overboard, you're all going to drown. So you all look after each other. And there's a lot of equality in that little ecosystem. And traditionally, many peoples that were expelled from their lands or escaping prosecution or whatever, turned to piracy on the high seas. It would, you know, made a lot of sense. However, something else is going on too, because what do pirates do? They go and invade and they rape and they murder and they pillage. So that's kind of what anger does. Anger in its own little ecosystem in our mind, it makes sense. And it's oblivious to the harm done to everybody and everything else around that eventually comes back on us. So I found the analogy, for me at least, of a pirate, it helps me not be as addicted to my own anger and feelings of justification. The other thing too is with pirate ships, you can see the Jolly Roger on the horizon, can't you? You can see the smoke on the horizon. You get warning. And the same with anger. We get warning before it's full blown. So what we've got to do is learn to listen to the warning signs before the pirates are there upon us and it's all too late. So the definition of anger, the reason why it's got all these different stages is that it helps us then unpick it. Because what we're going to do is not squish it down, but undo it so we no longer have it. So it's gone. So it's a deluded mental factor that observes a contaminated object, exaggerates its negative characteristics, then considers it undesirable and wishes to harm it. So interesting enough, the term anger up until the Middle Ages just meant hurt. It meant, you know, like you had an angry wound. It meant something that was sore. And then something, I don't know what happened, but in the Middle Ages, then the idea of retaliation was married to it. So you have hurt and then retaliation. So what we have from a Buddhist point of view is that it's a deluded mental factor, meaning that it's out of step with reality. It comes from confusion, so it's a mistake. We're already operating under mistake. And we know it's a mistake because we're agitated. We're not peaceful. The mind is not peaceful. So a deluded mental factor, even if it's just kind of being what we call under the weather, tired or unhappy, that observes a contaminated object, which means anything or anyone that's not enlightened, contaminated with disturbing emotions. Someone who's not perfect, or an object that is not perfect, like a car or a computer or anything else that you try and get to work. So a deluded mental factor in my mind, observing a contaminated object, something out there that's not perfect, and then exaggerating the negative characteristics. So just like attachment just looked at everything that was good, anger looks at everything you don't like, everything that's wrong with the person, everything that's not acceptable, and then exaggerates those. They become foremost in your mind and then can't find anything good about it. So consider, because it feels bad, looks bad, then consider it undesirable. Don't want it. Get rid of it at all costs. Get the person away from me. Get rid of the bad feeling. Make the person shut up. Force them to do whatever. Make incredible judgments. At the very least, just see it as useless and don't want it. And then, of course, the next thing is retaliate. Wish to harm. It's the very next step. Ill will, revenge. So if we want to get rid of anger, we have to undo this. So the first step is to not retaliate, to not harm. So even though we might have the wish, we don't have to act on it. That in itself would make the world a peaceful place, wouldn't it? Just that one thing, we could at least make a safe environment. But it's not enough. And it's not enough because there's all the rest still happening. So anger is still going to arise. And if you just try and squish it down with force, what happens when you get tired? That's when we retaliate, isn't it? When you have the flu or you're having a bad day, that's when you say the thing or lash out at the person. So we have to wind it back. So the next thing is, okay, so we don't retaliate, we zip our lip, and then instead of seeing that it's undesirable, we think, is there any benefit in this? Is there anything beneficial that can come from this problem or this thing going wrong? And I mean, even just in bad relationships, you know, the minimum that we can get from that is to go, I'm never going to mistreat someone like I've been mistreated. Hands down, no matter what, I am never going to do that to another human being. That in itself, you can benefit from that absolute certainty that no matter how you're treated, you're not going to mistreat others. That's a really big deal because most of the time it's transactional, isn't it? But if you know yourself, no matter what, I'm not going to mistreat others, then you have a natural confidence. You can trust yourself. And then we can wind it back and you go, okay, well, most of the time when we really, really hate something or someone, it's because we can't find anything good about them. But actually, if we just spend a little bit of time thinking about it, we could find something good about them. And then it takes the edge off. Then we wind it back further and go, well, of course, they're not perfect and neither am I. So how to deal with anger? It's one of the most important skills in the world, and yet are we taught it at school? Are we taught it at work? Sometimes, depending what job it is, you have to learn. But mostly not. And it's the number one skill that we need in the world is how to deal with anger and hostility. So questions about this definition? Yes, righteous anger, that's right. So you've got to really unpick that one because, so one thing, we've got to get our definitions right. And so from the Buddhist point of view, hatred has this intention to harm others. And generally, when we talk about anger and hatred, they're intertwinable. But actually, with anger, we can, instead of have the intention to harm others and kill the enemy, we can have the intention to help. So justified anger can be anger against a delusion, anger against someone's behavior, but not the person, anger against an unjust law, but not the people. So it's tricky. And you can see people with righteous anger, the ones that don't burn out are the ones that don't get those two things mixed up. And the ones that burn out are the ones that hate the aggressor, hate the oppressor. So it's tricky. And then because righteous anger, also there's energy in there for social change. But as we know, if social change comes about through violence, it's not sustainable. In fact, it can make things worse. Lasting social change has to come about through a whole lot of really boring background work and care and concern, hard work. Yes, anger can help you push against fear in the short term, but it makes the fear bigger. It means you have to keep on pushing against that fear all the time. You can never relax. So just like with attachment, you know, you get what you want in the short term, you go great, but then it wears off. So if we want to actually be free of it, it's not that, that's not going to be sustainable doing it that way. So let's have a look where anger comes from. So number one, anger comes from having an unhappy mind, being dissatisfied, annoyed, irritated. So like I was saying about road rage, you know, road rage seems to come from nowhere, but it comes from you're in your car and you have an unhappy, dissatisfied mind. but you don't know. If you got into your car and you'd just fallen in love with somebody and you're looking through the world with your rose-colored glasses, you know, you're in that first flush of woohoo, and everybody and everything's wonderful, and someone cuts you off in traffic, you go, "That's okay, darling, come on in." Because your mind is happy. So when you get into the car and you have road rage, and the number one, it's not coming from them. It's coming from our own mind and our own unhappiness. And we're just a bit disconnected and don't know that we're dissatisfied, unhappy, short-tempered. So what I've been noticing, you know, in these COVID times, and it's been quite a while since Brisbane's been out of lockdown, but have you noticed everybody's heightened anxiety, really quick to become angry and really quick to cry? Like, it's really up there, isn't it? So that's because we've got all of these unresolved things going on. We're grieving for the world and what's happened to the world. And we don't like it. We've got that thought, don't like it, don't want it. So the whole time we're living right next door to full-blown anger. So it just takes one thing and whoosh, people explode. And it's like, what? Where did that come from? But our whole society's like that now. And I started to think what's happening in the rest of the world, because we're actually safe here, you know, considering. So anger comes from an unhappy mind, and we don't want to face the unhappiness, so it turns into the anger. It's what happens when attachment does not get what it wants. So in a way, anger is like the true face of attachment. You know, at first the attachment, it feels good. That's a very cleverly disguised inner terrorist. But when attachment doesn't get what it wants, then the true face shows: anger, hostility, blaming others. So even our attachment to our ordinary lovely life, you know, we didn't even realize that it was driven by attachment until suddenly we couldn't go out because of lockdown, or suddenly we can't get the things that we want. And then we have anger and we think that's the problem. But actually the problem goes back to attachment, and that attachment problem goes back to confusion. So if you wake up and you recognize, oh, I'm a bit short-tempered today, or in my case, I start bumping into things, like a bit discombobulated, then take it easy. Actually give yourself a little bit more time and space so that it doesn't run away with you. Anger arises because of the reifying view. We'll get into that in one moment. There's also a whole lot of conditions and triggers that I thought I'd put in here. This comes from, I can't actually remember which, just kind of pop psychology book, Western book on anger, but it's really useful. And all of these things we would normally think of as the causes of anger, but they're not. They're not the root cause. They're triggers. They can never be the root cause, because if they were, then everybody else would respond in exactly the same way all the time. So what these things are, they're triggers. What the root cause is our unhappy mind. Because think, you know, if we're first falling in love, none of these things would trigger us. So having our wants or desires thwarted. So things just not going well. You go to do something and it goes wrong. You go to cook something, it goes wrong. Or you butter your toast and all your avocado goes splat onto the floor. All of those things, having our wants and desires thwarted, really triggers our retaliatory attitude. Feeling under attack, whether we actually are or not. So that kind of feeling in itself triggers our anger. So that can either come from fear, or it can come from just the weather, from things not going well. Dwelling on the faults of others. So instead of dwelling on the faults of anger, we dwell on the faults of the other person. And that only makes things worse. Setting ourselves apart, feeling that we're special, we're more important, we're different, a little bit of a double standard sometimes. We take things personally. So many times we'll hear something and we'll hear it as criticism or a judgment or someone being mean to us. You know, like in taxi driver, you're looking at me. You know, we hear it personally, whereas other people are just, you know, stumbling through their own lives. So if you're crossing the road and someone bumps you as you're crossing the road, if you've got a dissatisfied mind, you'll think, oh, and maybe bump them back again, or you get irritated with them. But very rarely do we go, oh, are they okay? Assuming things should work or should go as planned. There's a real red flag there. If you ever have that thought should coming up in your mind, that's a danger sign already. Because things won't go right all the time and they'll often go wrong, and that's in their nature. And assuming that others are in control or others should know better, which is the same thing. Other people don't know better, or maybe they do know better, but they're overwhelmed by their emotions. And they're probably just as shocked about them as you are. So the reifying view, the tyranny of the reifying view. Can't you just hear him say that? I mean, it still works. It still works for me anyway. So the reifying view is a bully. It's an inner bully. And it's part of our fundamental ignorance, and it's where all of our disturbing emotions come from. And what the reifying view is, grasping at what appears as being true. So you can kind of think, you know, look at Donald Trump and how Donald Trump appears to me, I think that is true. That's the reifying view. Or bad from its own side. Which you can also hear him say. I can't do his accent, so I won't even try. But anyway, so bad from its own side is when it feels bad, it is bad. When it looks bad, it is bad. When someone's showing an angry face at us, that's an angry person. But actually, when someone is showing an angry face at us, that's an unhappy person. But the reifying view cannot see that. It just sees anger, hostility, don't like it, bad from its own side. In fact, if a mother sees that angry person, they just, you know, see all the torment and their heart breaks. They see a distressed, beloved child. So things can't be bad from their own side. But why I like this picture is because Donald Trump also reckons everything's bad from its own side. So it's very helpful for us to remember. So what we think, our happiness or suffering comes from out there, from the thing out there. When we have, so, and it's the source of all of our afflictive emotions and suffering, this reifying view, it's to do with that fundamental ignorance or confusion that we have. And what the reifying view does, and why it's a tyranny, is it blinds us to any possibility of change, to seeing things in another way. So there's one group of people that are very good at working with this kind of thought transformation, and that is entrepreneurs. Because entrepreneurs see what everybody else sees as a problem and go, goody. I can see something in this, something to do, a little niche right there that nobody else has noticed, because everybody else is going, oh, no, this is awful, because it appears awful. And then we think it is, and then we can't see anything else except awful. So that's the tyranny of the reifying view, thinking from its own side it's bad. So even when we're thinking about aggressive people or destructive human beings or evil people, we're confusing them and their disturbing emotions, them and their actions. And if we really want to make any kind of social change or personal change, we've got to undo those two things. So Donald Trump's like my litmus test, you know. Can I feel about Donald Trump like a fellow human being with Buddha nature, with the potential to become liberated from suffering and all of its causes, and to develop all of the good qualities inherent in all of us? Can I feel as much care and concern and warmth towards Donald Trump as, you know, someone I know or love? Because equal human beings, equally important, has feelings, therefore matters. So the reason we can't is because we are under the tyranny of the reifying view. That's what stops us. Yes. So their minds being less than the animals, what do you think that means, though? So really the nature of the mind, remember, even Donald Trump's mind or whoever you want to, you know, put, is fundamentally pure, but within it, all the toxins. So an animal's type of mind full of aggression, for instance, you know, a crocodile style mind or a guard dog style mind. Yes, many human beings just fall into that, but that's not all we can be. And in fact, from a Buddhist point of view, that's not all those crocodiles and guard dogs can be either. So it's not inherently bad. It's just overwhelmed by negativity. But most of the time, we do actually operate under the same preoccupations as many of the animals. You know, animals build houses, collect all their stuff, look after each other. In fact, ants and bees have a way more complex social structure than human beings. So how are we any different? So under that way, on a relative level, yes. But fundamentally, we're the same. Yeah, consciousnesses are attracted from life to life. They're propelled to a life form that matches their consciousness. So the reifying view, it is a tyranny because it actually stops us recognizing the humanity of others. And isn't that one of the things that I don't like about Donald Trump? And yet here I am having that kind of response to him. So I have a little flowchart how this works. We have the reifying view, the distorted glasses, the distorted way that we look at the world. And we don't know that we're looking through the world like that, either through our rose-colored glasses or through our dark, smoky glasses, whatever it is. We're not seeing clearly. We're believing the appearances. So the appearances, angry person yelling at us, that's what we think that they are. And in our mind, we think they're like that 24/7, don't we? When someone's yelling at us, we're not thinking, oh, they're really nice and kind for 23 and a half hours of the day. No, we're just seeing like they've always been like that. So that's a reifying view. Then we exaggerate the faults. And so the faults, this is a little bit from His Holiness the Dalai Lama. A wise psychologist once told me that he'd come to the conclusion that when we feel lust or hatred, 80 to 90% of our perception of the object of our emotion is an exaggeration. He came to this conclusion not from reflecting on Nagarjuna's statements, but from his own analysis. Through unbiased investigation, you can come to understand how the mistaken assumption that phenomena exist independently in their own right serves as the basis of lust or hatred. When you find yourself in the grip of strong, afflictive emotions, examine whether that person or thing you lust after or hate so much actually exists as it appears. you'll see that its appearance involves an exaggeration. And when you do, your destructive emotion built on this misperception will wilt as if in embarrassment. When you do not challenge appearances, but assent to them and consider a person or object to be entirely good or bad through and through, this causes you to desire it in all respects or to feel intense hatred for it. At those times, you'll make strong statements such as, he's awful, she's really terrible, or he's terrific, she's fantastic. However, when you begin to see that this extreme degree of true goodness or badness that seems to be intrinsic to the person simply does not exist, the emotion that is built on that exaggeration backs off, as if it sees the mistake we've made and pulls back. So this is how the hostility arises. It's also how we can start to wind it back. So at least recognizing that what we're seeing, a whole lot of it, 80% of it, is our stuff. It's our baggage, our projections from our upbringing and how we were treated at school and all sorts of things like that. So that's those glasses that we're looking through. So we exaggerate all the faults, then we see no benefit, don't like it, don't want it. So because we can't see anything good about it, we think that's true. We don't think, oh, I haven't found anything good about it yet. We just 100% go, no, it's horrible, don't want it. Because of that, because there's no benefit, then we can't bear it. We find it unbearable. Everything in us goes, no. And the more that we focus on how unbearable it is, the worse we'll feel. Then we want to blame others. We just look outside of us for the cause. It's kind of a habitual thing that we do. So I noticed this just automatically. I open the fridge door, the butter falls out onto the floor, and I go, who put that there? There's this urge to blame somebody else for that. Like, I don't want that. Wasn't me. So, you know, if we are going to blame, we've got to blame the right thing. And the right thing is the reifying view, the disturbing emotions, not the person. But if we do blame others, if we think the cause of our suffering and our problems is out there, other people, then of course we're going to want to hurt them. We're going to retaliate, and there'll be nothing holding us back. So then we have an intention to harm, and if we suffer, we want them to suffer as much. We can't even see that, of course, they are suffering. So in a way, through the reifying view, you can see that violence in this little ecosystem makes it terrible kind of sense, but it is mistaken. So even that, when you think about really brutalized human beings that cannot interact well with others, that actually do harm others, you can see that it's come through this catastrophic set of circumstances and this process. And so from their point of view, they're acting logically, it makes sense, but actually it's built on this terrible mistake. And then if you act in retaliation or revenge, what's ever come from that? Not peace. You know, not even with wars. You might stop the enemy for a little while, but then you just end up with a bigger, more dispersed, longer term enemy. So it's never a long term solution. There are some things where we can see how this whole cycle doesn't have to complete itself. So you remember the other day I was talking about if you're running a marathon or you're going to the gym. Now, no one can tell me going to the gym is a pleasant experience, right? It's not like the same as luxuriating in a bath, for instance. So in this cycle, the reason I wouldn't go to the gym is because I exaggerate all the faults. So I think of all the things that hurt and how tired I am and I don't want to do it. And then I'm not looking at the benefit to me. I'm just going, no, don't like it, don't want it. And then if someone made me go, I'd find it unbearable. But clearly there are gyms out there. So clearly people don't find it unbearable. And why? Because instead of seeing no benefit, instead of just looking at all the pain, what are they looking at? And why do they have mirrors in the gym? To help you. What? Yes. See the benefits. See how you're getting more buff and fit to help you keep on going there. So it's possible. It's possible to do, to naturally wind this back. And we can work on every stage of the cycle, but normally what happens is we just try to not retaliate. We try and be a good person and not retaliate. We still might have blame inside. We still might harbor a whole lot of blaming everything and everyone out there. We still have this feeling of it's unbearable in our own mind, so we have no peace, so we haven't actually solve the problem. And that's why it'll come back up again very easily. So strategies to overcome hostility. Prevention is the very, 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 very best one. Heed the warning signs of an unhappy mind. And when we notice that we are unhappy or we're a bit short-tempered or a bit out of sorts, instead of dwelling on everything going wrong or getting sulky, remind yourself about how toxic anger is. Start on the little small things. So when the toast falls down, that's the place to start, the easy one. So that you start building up your muscles, your emotional muscles. And try and remember some good things. Well, at least I have a toaster. Can you imagine if I had to build my own fire? I'd starve. So just shifting our awareness a little bit can change everything. Prevention also means the things that really are going wrong in life, the really big issues, we have to make time to sit and think about them and work them through. We can't just go, no, now's not a good time. I don't want to do it now. We have to make the time. And preferably in the morning when you're feeling all positive and happy and or you had a meal, you're feeling relaxed, strong, that's when to do it. Once anger started to arise and the adrenaline has surged through, you can't put it back in the bottle, so then run away. That's when you remove yourself from the situation so you don't make it worse. Go and lock yourself in the toilet. You know, or count, or in your mind, how you count to 10. Don't say anything till you count it to 10. Refrain from harm. At least have a very firm determination in your mind. You're not going to punch them in the nose and you're not going to say the spiteful thing. Even if it's all happening in your mind, you're not going to express it physically or verbally. So my trick for this one is to run away, and I say to myself, yeah, Miffy, you can deal with it, just not at this moment, a little later, tomorrow or in half an hour, to just put it off a bit. Patience, which we'll get to in a moment. When anger is stopped by patience, the result is happiness, feeling at ease. So your mind is at ease in the face of a disturbing situation, keeping your mind at ease. And actually your mind is accompanied by compassion, big-heartedness. The opposite of hatred or anger is actually love, loving kindness. So as a way of changing that internal atmosphere of our mind, if we try and develop our loving kindness as a quality. Every day, think about the kindness of others, the good qualities of others, how we wish them well. Remember that we like them. Remember that you like the people that you live with. You know, remember that you care about the people that you work with. So actually focus on those things. Then you create that inner atmosphere. Then it's very difficult for anger to arise. You can't have anger and love at the same time. So if you start the day with loving kindness, there's no room for the anger to come in. It's like you can't have gentleness and hostility at the same time. They just can't exist simultaneously. It's one or the other. So if you are proactive and you choose to develop love and care and kindness in your heart as an ongoing attitude, that's like the very best defense. So patience. Three types of patience. One, remaining at ease towards someone or something harmful. So how do we do that? I put here a poor sleep-deprived mother and a screaming, teething toddler. So how do you do it? One of the things is to recognize that someone harmful, they have no freedom. They have no freedom from their disturbing emotions, from their fears, from their anxiety, from their wish for things to be different. They have no freedom. Whether they're a grown-up, whether they're a child, no one acts out through a happy mind. People act out through unhappiness. So that's really number one. To think of them as they're temporarily insane, or they're bullied by their disturbing emotions. So when a mother sees a crying child, they will see the anger, but they'll also underneath see the hurt, and they'll be wondering what's wrong. So why? Because the mother actually has developed care for that child. So our approach as Buddhists is to try and develop equal care for everybody, not just the ones that we're biologically close to this time, but for everybody that we live with, everyone in our society. We can also recognize that we suffer because we have the potential to suffer in our own mind. It's our capacity for suffering. We have dissatisfaction in our own mind. We have fear and worry and all of those things. So, of course, things are going to trigger us. So Venerable Robina said this really interesting thing. She said, instead of going, oh, why me, go, well, why not? Recognizing that we both have faults. There may be a difference in degree. Someone else may be far more aggressive or violent than you, but it's not like we're fundamentally different. And this is something quite different from our Western kind of way of doing things, because when people act really badly, we call them evil, or we call them animals or not human. And then we put ourselves apart from them. And that's actually one of the ways that people become brutalized, that they look at others, like in war, you look at others, you dehumanize them. So the moment you do that, it's just catastrophe is going to follow. And we do that with people who act really, really badly. We think they are bad. And so then we go, they're evil, and they're not even human, they're animals. If we do that, we've just shut the door to any reconciliation or help whatsoever. Even if That person is so brutalized that in this life they can't be helped. At least they can be removed from society. But if then we go and punish, then we create harm to ourselves as well. So both of us have faults. And actually, if we're brave enough and we can see the mirror image in us, so if I can look at Donald Trump and see where I have those same characteristics. So the benefit of that is that gives me a window in to communicating with someone like Donald Trump. And how else are we going to change the world unless we can go, you're just like me? So it takes a huge amount of courage to do that. And the start of it is to recognize we both have faults, we're both seeking happiness. And there can be a benefit. So I'm going to read you a little thing from Lama Yeshe, and you'll see how radical Buddhist psychology is. Like, there's nothing else like it in the world. So Lama Yeshe says, no matter how much wealth and material we've accumulated, and no matter how many decades we've studied, no matter how good our reputation, no matter how many people we have below us working for us, if we don't practice patience and the good heart, we'll have no peace of mind at all. Even if we've spent millions of dollars on houses all over the world, as long as we haven't dealt with the self-cherishing mind, we'll have no peace of mind. Where does peace of mind actually come from? It comes from the enemy. In practice, the person who disturbs us is the one who offers us peace of mind. By practicing patience and generating loving kindness and compassion for this person, our anger diminishes. Year by year, we find it harder and harder to get angry. And when we do, it lasts for shorter and shorter periods of time. Friends and helpers don't give us the opportunity to practice patience, loving kindness, and compassion. We have to rely on enemies for that. So I've got to say, that just blows my mind. But it's really true. It's only through difficulties that we have strength, that we have strength of character. And it's only from really coming up against people acting badly that we know how to act or not. And while everything's going well and while everybody's being nice, so when I first came to Lungri Tumpa Center, and you know, I'm volunteering in a Buddhist center like this, everybody that comes in here is trying to be a good person. Everybody's on their best behavior. Everyone's really nice, you know, all of this. So I'm just swanning along going, oh, life is great. Everybody's wonderful. I'm pretty cushy. You know, I've got lots of patience and tolerance, yada, la, la. But actually it's the conditions. So what would keep my feet on the ground was every fortnight going to put my doll form in the valley, right? So the valley doll office, the furniture's bolted to the floor. The rubbish bins are bolted to the floor. There's nothing you can pick up and throw. There's like screens. And so you walk in and it's a great leveler. Right then I can see, am I tolerant? Am I kind? Am I naturally joyous? Or is it just because my conditions have been wonderful? So it became, again, a really good little thermometer, how I was going, and really important to keep yourself grounded. So it's been a while since I've been in there. It could be actually quite nice by now, but it was a hairy experience, I've got to say. Yes. No, this is like how we need problems. We need enemies to develop patience. This is the benefit. We need to have all of the difficult situations or we will never get a chance to develop patience. We'll never have a chance to figure out how to keep our mind happy regardless of what's going on. Because if we are beholden only to the circumstances, when circumstances go wrong, what are we going to do? And so even if we live the very best life where everybody's really nice to us and we have all of these nice houses and whatever, we don't have peace of mind. Or even if we do, well, what about if we manage to get old and sick? You know, then how are we going to just deal with the pain in our body? So we need difficulties. We need enemies. We need problems. That's the benefit. So then the next kind of patience then is having this attitude of voluntarily accepting suffering. And this is what you do when you go to the gym or you run a marathon or you try and cook dinner or whatever it is, you know. You have this attitude, I'm going to run into this suffering instead of, no, I don't want to. We're going to voluntarily accept suffering. In a situation that we can do nothing about, we bear it with a happy mind. So many people who are born with a disability have to learn this skill very, very quickly. So, you know, I keep on harping on about this wonderful show, You Can't Ask That. So the one with facial differences or disabilities, I think, and these horrendous disabilities that people have. And they're really amazing people and they're really positive. And it's not fake positivity, it's genuine. So how does this come from? From actually voluntarily bearing suffering. You can bitch about it or not. It's not going to change the situation. So we change our mind. And in fact, a lot of people with disabilities, it ends up because of their incredible attitude, it ends up that they can become advocates. They can help others. They really contribute way more to society than just an ordinary person. And it's because of this incredible skill, bearing difficulties with a happy mind. And the way that we can start doing this is with the weather. So when I first moved to Brisbane from Melbourne, I grew up in Melbourne, cold, cold, cold. Moved to Brisbane my first summer. Oh, I'll never forget it. I was so unhappy and I was so angry. And I would just throw a tantrum. I can't bear this anymore. One more second. Literally lying on the floor because it was cool, banging my fists on the floor. I was like 14 years old or something and just lost it. So it doesn't change the weather, does it? So I went through about a year doing that, just being beside myself, and then I realized this isn't going to work. So then what I pretended to do at school when I get really, really hot, no air conditioning, I pretend to be Swiss cheese. And I think the heat is just coming into me and it's going through and leaving. And then that way I just relax like a sponge. The heat is coming and it's going and I'm just relaxing. And it worked. Okay, then the third type of patience is something that we don't necessarily identify as patience, which is developing certainty in the Dharma. So it's a certainty that even though we cannot control the world, the things around us, the circumstances, we can control our mind. We can protect our own mind. So no matter what happens, we'll be okay. We'll stay calm. So in Buddhism for Dummies, which is an excellent book, this is what Jonathan Landau says. So throughout this book, we talk about the practice of Dharma, basically training your mind as being the only reliable way of protecting yourself and fulfilling your highest potential, training our mind. But old habits are hard to break. So when difficulties arise, your tendency is to react to them in the same unskillful and destructive ways you've always used. In other words, when push comes to shove, you tend to forget all the Dharma you've ever heard and shove back. So this third aspect of patience involves searching for the appropriate Dharma solution to each problem you face, and then making the concerted effort to apply this solution directly to your present situation, no matter how hard it may be. So it's having this confidence that actually we can do it, remembering we have the tools to use and that we can apply them. And so that's why the picture of the umbrella, because most of the time we're trying to change everybody, we're trying to change the world. And it's like trying to stop the rain. It's trying to make snow. No rain, you go back up there. But actually, if we got an umbrella, if we protected our mind, if we figured out how to develop our capacity for kindness, for tolerance, for patience, for empathy, and we actually protected our own mind, it's like an umbrella. We can go anywhere, in any weather. We'll have natural confidence. We'll be protected. So it means that you can go into difficult situations, everybody's really scrappy and angry, and you won't be affected. You won't take on that kind of bad mood as well. In fact, you'll be able to be the calming influence. So that gives us a lot of courage. If we understand our own mind and we actually start taming our mind, starting from right at the end of not retaliating and then winding it back slowly, 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 we won't panic. And panic is the thing that really causes us to act badly, that makes us catastrophize, that creates that momentum of anxiety and depression, keeps it going. So, questions, comments, three types of patience. Do you recognize that you do any of those to a degree already? So these are the, you know, they're to continually work on, to get really strong at. It's quite different from if someone's annoying you, just kind of going bland and not feeling anything. That can help in the short term. It might stop us retaliating, but it won't help in the long term. So this actually, patience and remaining at ease towards someone harmful is because our mind is infused with kindness and compassion, not just being blank.
After that.
Yeah, that's right. But what that does, so, and often people, it's that cliche, isn't it? The straw that broke the camel's back. So what that shows is that our sense of calm and ease comes from outside of us, comes from our circumstances. And so while our circumstances are okay, everything's okay. But then, you know, if a dog starts barking on that side and the jackhammer starts on this side and you start getting really uncomfortable and you need to go to the loo and someone else is yelling and have an argument, one of those things is going to set you off and then you think it's that fault. But actually, why are we set off? Because that baseline in our mind, not happy. So, yes, children will stretch you. But isn't that a good thing? That's actually not just good for you and for the children, but for all of society, if you can actually stretch and grow into that and be able to remember, oh, yeah, they may appear to be a monster right now, but I know they're not. The reifying view is not going to get me. Yes, so remaining at ease doesn't mean being passive. It might mean actually if someone's being really aggressive, that your mind can stay very calm so you know exactly how to get out of the situation. Yes, so if you're not up to it and you can run away, great, but we have to practice. And what do we do when we can't run away? So when we can't remove ourselves from the situation, so often what we do just normally, psychologically, is we run away to a happy pace in our mind. And so Western psychology calls that becoming disassociated. But actually, it's quite a natural response. And for a short-term preservation method, it's very good. But what we're going to learn to do that is harness that. Do it consciously. Have the mind happy regardless. So, you know, like someone like Nelson Mandela or something stuck into prison and recognized they may imprison me, you know, the rain of misfortune coming down on my head, but my mind is my own. So while we can control our circumstances a little bit, we think we have the leisure to not be elevated. We think we have the leisure to chuck a tantrum or to put it off or to go away. But it's a very short-term leisure. Probably, I'd say, different thing for children, though, because, you know, children are so much more vulnerable and haven't learnt these skills, whereas as adults, we've got a lot more resources at our disposal. When we're talking about anger, it's not so much the anger coming from other people, but if the anger's coming up in us and we can't deal with it in the spot, that's when we have to run away because it stops us retaliating. Patience, calm down, abolish anger. Right. So yes, that's like a colloquial mantra, isn't it? Yes. So that will do in the heat of the moment, because when you're saying that, you're not saying all the other horrible stuff. But it won't do in the long term, because the reason we get angry at others is because of the reifying view. We're seeing the problem and the anger, and we're not seeing the potential in that person. We're not seeing the suffering. We're not seeing how we can help. We're not seeing how they're just like us. And how can they let themselves go like this? So short term, yes. Long term, then in our window of opportunity, that's when we have to do the work. And how many of us do? Only when really terrible things happen to us and we're forced to. And that's why this whole anger and depression thing is so beneficial for us, because that forces us to do something. Our ordinary way of going about it hasn't, you know, worked. Yeah, so with any kind of personality disorder, even with acquired brain injury, with neurodivergence, all of those kinds of things, even with how we're born genetically, it's not just a one thing, because depending on our environment and our attitude, we can change the expression of our genetic potential. So that's for all sorts of things, like whether you're predisposed to diseases, anything like that. It's not just a done deal. You've got this gene, it's going to end up like this. Depending on what kind of environment you have, you can change it. So the same with any kind of disorder. When you have a disorder, it can become a hidden strength. So I've noticed over the years, many people who come to Lungri Tumpa Centre who've had mental illness have this ability to recognise when they're going off. They have this reflective capacity to notice when they're starting to go off, and they have a sense of real humility about it. And a humility as a human being that a whole lot of other people don't, that just arrogantly go through life. And that humility translates as them being actually quite kind, empathetic people. So, yeah, you've got something that can be quite disabling, but it can make you a much better human being. So it doesn't have to be a terrible thing. And many people, through the difficulties that they have, come out the other end and they're the ones that can really help everybody else, because they're legit. You know, because who's going to go to a psychologist that's never experienced any trauma? Like, are we going to believe them? No, it just comes from a book. So it's going to take a lot of work, but we tend to have this kind of biological determinism, and that's just not founded in reality. We have to keep being, I'm just going to get to the last slide. We're going to do that one next week. When we feel we don't have the capacity, we kind of got to know what our limit is at the time and remove ourselves before we retaliate. But then we've got to think, that's the beginning of the story. Now I have to do my own work in my own time. So it's just like getting fit. You know, we're going along doing something, then we realize we've got no more strength. Oh my gosh, what's happened? I really let myself go. Okay, I've got to go and work on it. Or you can be like me and just lie on the couch and go, oh, you know, I really got to work on this. So we have to know our own limits, yes, but don't think that's it. That's all I can do. We can always do something. Yeah. So, okay. The general definition of anger when we talk about anger in Buddhism is this intention to harm. Everything else before that, annoyance, frustration, everything, it's not full-blown anger yet. And anger has this retaliation kind of thing. So stuff like righteous anger, for instance, it may not have an intention to harm. Or maybe we can take out the intention to harm and just keep the urge for change. Hostility coupled with indifference is what makes us destructive. So if we develop loving kindness and care, we'll lessen our indifference. The greatest harm of anger is definitely to ourselves. Patience is the remedy, not just for anger, but for all difficulties, all problems, anything that goes wrong, anything that we don't like. And it's a mind at ease, a relaxed mind in the face of adversity. So it's not tight, tight, gritting your teeth. It's relaxed, open, confident. So the homework, there's the anger worksheet. There's a feeling tone meditation, and there's also a meditation on the kindness of others to do. And we might do that kindness of others meditation as well in a fortnight. There's countless TV homeworks to do, but the one I really love is Airport USA and Hotel Impossible. But Airport USA in particular, because the help desk, the help desk anywhere where people come and they're just angry and they lost their luggage. And so what they say about Airport USA is that they employ people who are already kind, and then they just teach them what to say. And they really demonstrate this incredible respect for others. And Hotel Impossible, which I really love too. It's the bald guy. And he really is able to sort out the people's crazy behavior from the wonderful people. Ramsay's Kitchen Nightmares, etc. Well, you know, that's a bit dicey, isn't it? That one, we all know that's falls on both sides of the fence. Okay, and then next week, finding the wisdom in depression and Buddha's radical remedies for depression. Because with anger, so we have this burst of anger, but if we just push it down, then comes depression. So we'll have a look what to do about that next week so we don't lose all of our energy. Let's dedicate the merits. Sorry, I've gone over again. So take a moment to acknowledge all your efforts and your patience in staying over time, and how you're probably able to do that because you're thinking of the benefits. So dedicate all of the what we've talked about tonight, reflecting on this material and your practice of patience. May you develop it to its utmost extent to have an open heart and natural confidence, and to be able to bring peace and harmony to the world, to create peace and harmony and dismantle anger. So that way we can dedicate for our own well-being, the well-being of everybody around us in our immediate family and work, and for our whole community, the whole world. Okay, thank you everybody. I hope to see you next week. Online people, give me 1 minute. Hello, Louise. How are you?
Yeah, I'm well, thank you. Thanks for answering that question earlier on email.
Yeah, I was thinking, so Corey Jackson has his own website. I think if you just look up Corey Jackson CEB, you'll be able to find it. And he's got some teachings and stuff on YouTube and things like that. But that's where the information comes from. This trajectory of the initial experience, the 90 seconds, and then the tailing away. But I'll talk about it more next week too.
Oh, good. Okay, excellent. Because I've seen it in some of the notes and I thought, I can't remember what you said about it, but it was interesting.
Yeah, so it's kind of like when those the blips, the emotional sensations, the fears, the worries, the, all of those things, as they arise in the mind, then we, if we don't like them, we go, no. So that makes them arise again. And then we go, no, and that makes it happen again.
Whereas you said it just can go on for weeks and years and
So if we develop that fortitude to be able to have it arise and sit with it without having to do anything about it, notice it, describe it, investigate it, the nature of it will change. And the intensity, the urge to retaliate, to get rid of it, to grasp it, whatever it is, will tail off. And then the length of time between the sensation, the emotional sensation arising and us reacting, we want to make that length of time longer and longer.
Yeah, yeah.
So minimum, if you can try for 90 seconds, even just a few seconds, though, neurologically. So there is a book called by Jeffrey Schwartz called You Are Not Your Brain. And he's a neuroscientist, and he investigated this, and he did a lot of work with obsessive compulsive disorder. Mm. And so for people to change their OCD, it was to recognize the feeling, say the checking compulsion. It was this really nice trajectory. Say you've got a checking compulsion, is that did you leave the tap on? Before you leave the house, you go and you check the tap and you look at it in all different ways. Visually, you put your hand under, is it dripping? You feel it's turned off, so that in all the different senses, you've ascertained that the tap's off. And then you leave the house and then the compulsion goes, I've got to check the tap. Mm. So that compulsion, normally you have to go and check. It's like this, it's like that feeling like when a sneeze is coming. You absolutely have to do it. So Jeffrey Schwartz said you have to pause and actually not go and check. Pause and bring to mind, now I put my hand under it, I couldn't feel any water. I felt the tension of the tap. There was no way that it was on. I didn't hear anything. I didn't see anything. And so as you're verifying all of that in your mind, that urge to check slowly subsides. And then he said, then you can go check, but you have to do it really mindfully without doing anything else at the same time.
Mm.
So then you go and check and you verify again. Okay. And then you leave. And then the thing, oh, got to check, that compulsion comes up again. Then you pause and you make the pause. So the pause, you'll always feel there's tension there. Mm. And that's a good thing. And the wonderful thing that he said about that was that any kind of tension that we have where we're pausing and we're not retaliating, we're not doing the thing, we're not checking, the tension comes because neurologically it's evidence that our brain is being rewired. So it's just like the burn when you're doing muscles at the gym and your muscles get sore. Yes. It's like that's a good sign. It means they're growing.
It is a good sign.
Yeah. So thank if you have that thing, got to do the whatever, that urge to change, and you don't give into it, then you don't even have to get rid of that tension because you can go, that's my brain rewiring.
Yeah.
I'm doing my best to practice. I moved. That's why you haven't seen me. I've just been all over the place. However, keeps on springing to mind. Everything keeps springing to mind when I'm really down and anxious. I've got so much anxiety at the moment. And I breathe and I see this and I see the sky above me is clear. And I check what it feels like and so on. And I find it does help. At that time, at that point when it's worst, it does help. And I can actually feel the lessening of the pressure.
Yeah. So, Angela, in terms of our internal weather, it sounds like you're going through a massive storm, you know. Like when there's a storm, when there's a cyclone and everything's just flying around and whatever, all you can do is just kind of try and stay still and weather it, literally. So if you're moving house and you've had these catastrophic things happen to you just recently in your life, then probably all you can do is literally just weather it. And that's that form of patience, of just bearing what's happening and trying to relax in amongst it.
But going back to the bearing part, I'm very good at bearing things in life, over life, you know, even from a little girl, I would just, you know, purse my lips and get on with it, sort of stuff. And when in this situation, when you're anxious and you're bare, and as you say, it's all whipping around you, and I just think it's my karma. It's to do with conditions. It's to do with, you know, at this point, this is where my karma is. You know, it is karma, isn't it? I mean.
Yeah, so, but it's all different types of karma, because one, it's ripening karma. And we've created through our confusion, we've created the causes for this to happen to us. Just like when we retaliate and we make life worse, you know, we didn't intend to make life worse, but we do. And then we get the results of it. So, yeah, but not only that, when we recognize that, then you can extrapolate it out to it's the same for everybody else.
Yeah.
You know, they're also in this storm. They're also going through through all of the results, you know, terrible results of karma, you know, just like you.
Yes, and I do bear that in. I do have that in my mind that, quite honestly, I'm well looked after in comparison to so many beings in this world. And however, you know, when you were talking tonight about it's not just with anger in relation to anger, and patience, it's not about just keeping in, holding yourself so you don't
lash out. Pushing it down, kind of.
So that's bearing, isn't it? And you were saying don't push it down.
Mm.
And so in the way of what I'm talking about, I am conscious that you have to be at ease in that situation.
Yeah, so one is suppressing it, and Lama Yeshe talked about it, it's like squeezing your mind, and that's not sustainable.
No.
That's where we actually end up having a breakdown, because that's the only way that we can relax our mind. So suppressing our speech and our actions is good, but suppressing our mind won't work.
No, so this is where we bring in the knowing that our mind is pure and I guess has a calmness within it. And
yeah, that's right.
These are the clouds that go over it.
And all of that is you're in this intense weather system, but where's the weather system? In the infinite spaciousness of your mind. And so then that way, at least you don't become one with the weather system.
No. And so I'm like having the hurricane go around me.
Yeah, that's right. And then all the different ways that you, you know, what happens, then all of this you will be able to use to help others.
Oh, yes. In the,
you know, and when somebody else goes through the same thing, you'll be able to say, this is, yes, this is what happened to me, and this is what you can do, and yes, you can get through it.
And it tells you also, and I do have this in my mind, is that quite honestly, you know, we're always projecting into the future. Well, forget about it.
Well,
yes, it is there. But
actually, Angela, whilst all the anxiety is ripening as like this momentum, that's the present. So you'll be free of it in the future.
Yes. Well, I mean, one hopes to be. I hope to be. I'm working on it.
The other thing too that you can do that's very radical, and we kind of talked about it a little bit the week before last where we looked at anxiety, that when it is full blown, when everything is swirling around you, instead of fighting it, say, bring it on. Let me have everybody's anxiety, and I'm going to give it to the reifying view. I'm going to give it to the self-cherishing and the self-grasping, because that's who caused it. So instead of trying to get rid of it, you know, when it's already happening, you can't unhappen it. It's like when you've got the flu, you can't unhave the flu. You have to live through it. So when it's all arising and it's already there, Angela, then take more.
Okay, and put it on the...
Put it on the self-cherishing, the self-grasping attitude, that fundamental ignorance, the reifying view. Give it to that one, the troublemaker.
I'll practice that this week particularly.
And so then when it's happening, when you're really anxious, then actually just think, like, you know, that's the Tonglen on the breath. You breathe it in, you just think, I'm going to breathe in. Everybody in Brisbane who's suffering anxiety, I'm going to breathe it in and take it off them because it's awful. And you breathe it in right to give it to that, you know, Donald Trump. Give it to the reifying view. Give it to that self-grasping ignorance that's been our internal terrorist. And so then just think every time you breathe, think you're freeing everybody of it. Give it to me. Bring it on. Give me more. If I'm going to suffer it, I'm going to suffer it well.
Yeah. And practice and use it as practice.
Yeah. So you breathe in the hurricane, the typhoon, and then you breathe out sunlight, warmth, peace, calm.
I feel beautiful.
And then you breathe in the typhoon, hurricane, anxiety, and you breathe out, give them all the warmth and the calm, what everybody needs. And don't we know what they all need?
Great. I'll do that. Thank you.
Let me know how you go, Angela.
I will.
That one, Angela, has a very profound psychological effect, and it ties into what you were asking, Louise, of this. Because it means that even when we're breathing, we're not fighting against the experience, we're going with it. But it's like this amazing martial arts move, you know, you take the momentum of what's happening and you harness it. So instead of fighting against the anxiety and fighting against the worry and fighting against all of that inner turmoil, it's kind of like you have it contained there. You say, bring it on, it's okay. I can encompass all of this inner turmoil. Let's take it off everybody. And so stopping fighting it is actually the key. And then it can become a real strength. So then whenever you feel that, instead of being terrified or going, oh, no, here it comes again, or I can't bear this, it will become your strength.
So, you know, in your book list in the back of the notes,
yep.
Which is the best one to read for more on that, you know, managing anxiety and trying to sit with it and be calm after, but actually sit with it. That's, you know, that.
Yes. You know, the change of heart is particularly good for anger and turmoil, hatred, difficulties, those kind of things. Lots of really good stuff about how to deal with social injustice without getting angry but still doing something.
Mm-hmm.
There are really good meditations in how to meditate. That's like a meditation manual. So there are visualization meditations, there are psychological ones, there are handy hints on how to approach meditation.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really useful book, that one.
Okay.
Come to think of it now, since I put this reading list together, there have been other books come out too that are really excellent. So one that's just a very general all-rounder, really good one is by His Holiness the Dalai Lama and Thupten Chodron, called The Foundation of Buddhist Practice. And it'll be the workbook for the foundation course next term, because that takes a lot of Buddhist psychology from a Western point of view. So His Holiness and Thupten Chodron together. And I'm amazed, I haven't put in here Open Heart, Clear Mind. What an error. So the other book that's not in here with these readings is Thupten Chodron, Open Heart, Clear Mind. So that's kind of Buddhism, but from a psychological point of view.
Okay. Yeah, that's interesting. Open Heart, Clear Mind. Okay.
Yeah. But this series with His Holiness, the Dalai Lama and Thupten Chodron, the really beautiful covers, it's a whole series that's come out and it's just dynamite. It's kind of it's very accessible. It's contemporary and it's not watered down. It's this amazing tone to it that's quite extraordinary. It's the first of that kind of series. So,
okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. Anybody else have? Nicola, hello.
Hi.
Oh, there you are. Yes.
Hello, everyone. I just had a question about that when we were talking about the anxiety thing, about Shantideva's quote about if you can't do anything about it, why worry? But if you can, why worry? And then I was also thinking about, you know, voluntarily accepting suffering. And it made me think of my grandmother, who was very happy, but she would move to a place, she'd be very happy, and then she'd hate the neighbours. She'd be very happy looking for a house, very happy finding one, very happy packing, very happy all the way up until she was settled again, and then she was unhappy. So I'm just wondering where the line is between manipulating those external things. You know, if you don't like your nose, you can get a nose job. And where's the line,
dear? Yeah.
Between voluntarily, you know, having the stone in your shoe to understand what it's like, or getting that thing out, you know?
I mean, it's funny, isn't it? Because people say if you're depressed, just walk around with some stones in your shoes. And, you know, it's so incredibly painful that when you take your shoes off, it just feels so good. But that's the thing. That whilst we rely on our well-being coming from outside of us, we are beholden to what's outside of us. Mm-hmm. And so we'll be able to adjust this and adjust that a little bit, but it won't ever last. There'll always be something. If it's not the neighbours, it'll be the house or the body corporate or the, you know, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And because we're in a leisured society, we can continue to adjust things and think, if I just get a better house, everything will be okay. And that's a big, big trap. So one of the things with poorer societies where you can't get a better house, then what do you do? When you can't change your neighbours, then what do? Then you have to work with your own mind. And so that's where there's the benefit in having problems. That's where we need our enemies and we need our problems, or we never have to work with our own mind whilst we can keep on changing. But it's interesting, like you said, you know, about the nose job, because I watched those that botched and all the plastic surgery things.
I love that. There's
people that can that get addicted to plastic surgery because they don't get the satisfaction they want from the plastic surgery, because they it's not about getting the nose job or the boob job. It's about your capacity for happiness, your capacity for feeling content. And whilst you have all the disposable income to have plastic surgery, you can think it's going to come from the plastic surgery. But of course, with the botched show, what happens is once you have too much plastic surgery, everything goes wrong. And then you've ruined your body. And then they come along and try and fix up these just catastrophic bodies. But that's what we do emotionally. We go from this to that to this. This one will do it. This one will do it. And we never actually look at our own state of dissatisfaction. So I suppose, Nicola, where we draw the line is when we actually become aware of our dissatisfaction to say, good. Now I get to do something. Now I actually get to look at what's going on in my mind. So that's more to do with the, with attachment, I suppose. If we follow the attachment and we keep on trying to change things and adjust our comfort levels all the time, nagging anxiety is going to come up. Things are going to change. What if it goes wrong? What if this? What if that? All of that anxiety. And anxiety incapacitates us. So, like I'm just thinking about, you know, when COVID hit and everything had to change and we had to bring everything online. So I felt like I was in a maelstrom. There was so much I had to get my head around and learn how to do, and big decisions to make, not just one or two, but many in a row, and each one depending on the other one. It was so intense. If I had have actually been riven by anxiety as well, I wouldn't have been able to do a thing. So it was a maelstrom. There was all this change. It wasn't pleasant. It really, really stretched me, but I had to keep my mind calm in amongst it all, or Lungry Tumper Centre would have closed. So, and that's just not an option. So I didn't have the leisure to fall apart. And then, like, I really had to find that even keel of equilibrium in amongst the maelstrom and voluntarily bear the suffering of it and the pressure. Oh, my God. So, and it was really sustained. I think it was like, you know, 8 months up until the end of last year, it was continuous. And so what I've noticed now is from this year, from when we opened to now, I'm still a wreck. And I've had to actually notice I'm still really emotionally vulnerable and I'm still really up and down, and to just be patient with that too, to incorporate that in, because that's the result of 8 months of just too much intensity. So then you have to be patient with that as well, not berate yourself, not expect too much, take things a little bit slower. When you get upset, not get too upset. Notice, oh, wow, I really got off the deep end there. Oh, it's okay. So, you know, there's all this stuff that happens to us, and then the crucial thing is how we respond. We can't get rid of the problems. The problems are going to be there until we're enlightened. We can get rid of making them really worse and really suffering in them. So what I could say is, like, in all of this intensity with going on, bringing all of our curriculum online, I didn't suffer. Like, I wasn't in emotional torment. It was really hard and it was incredibly challenging, but I wasn't suffering in misery.
We're so grateful to you for doing that.
Oh, absolutely.
It was, I've got to tell you, it was the most uncanny feeling, because I had like a week to do 2 months' work. And I also knew, like, this, we've just got to grasp this right now, or decades of work is going to go down the gurgler. And I had this sense of enormity about it, like, this is really big, and you got to just grasp onto it and hold on for dear life. And that's really what got me through, was this is so much bigger than me, and I just happened to be here and happened to have the capacity to do it. So I've just, you know, like, I'm the one, I have to do it, whether I felt like I could or you know, irrelevant. I just happened to be there.
And you didn't feel anxious?
I didn't feel anxious, but I felt incredible pressure, just unrelenting pressure. Yeah. And that's not pleasant. But anxious, I mean, my anxiety now is a finely honed tool. Because it's just like analysis, and I just go over everything, and I go over it forward order and I go over it backward order. And if this happens, then da 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 da. Someone told me the other day, it's like branch thinking, you know, an analysis. If this goes wrong, then this, then what if this happens? What if this happens? Well, we do this. Okay. So I can do something about five of those things. I'll do that. Okay, now what if this happens? Then I could do something about that. That can't do anything about that, but somebody else can continuously.
That's really helpful, seeing your anxieties could be a tool, something to help you rather than you know, lop you off at your knees, which it feels like sometimes, you know.
It lops you off at your knees if you're trying to get rid of it.
Yes.
But actually what anxiety can do is very precisely analyze things, and especially things that can go wrong. And so if you're organizing anything, if you're an event planner or if you're an engineer, building bridges or skyscrapers in an earthquake zone or something like that, you need it. You need the adrenaline, you need the fear, you need the absolute concentration and the obsession, and to stay with it for hours and hours on end until a new little bit comes up and you go, oh, I didn't see that problem. So it's absolutely invaluable. But if you don't like the feeling of it, then you lose it. You lose all the benefit, and you lose the ability, and then the anxiety just sweeps over you and you become incapacitated. So much of it is just to not worry whether you feel good about it or not. So I didn't even have any time to feel anything. And then, like, 8 months later, I looked around and I went, oh, my God, the house is a mess. I've lost all my money. Don't know where the fridge is anymore. It's like, oh, my God, what happened?
It's an amazing thing you did. My goodness, we're so grateful.
Nicola, the other thing too, like, I had a similar experience when we first moved here to Lungri Tampa Centre. There was an equal amount of pressure going from, Inter's little house in Newmarket, all just by donation. I don't think we even had FPOS, you know, to coming to a big centre with a mortgage the first time ever. Huge amount of pressure. So I think that wasn't anxiety. That was just depression. I was depressed for a whole year, completely miserable. And I thought, oh, my God, this is my life and I don't want it. So, you know, I even had suicidal thoughts about it. I didn't believe the thoughts, but I felt suicidal. And that was a really different kind of beast, because I hadn't kind of got a handle on the stress and the pressure.
So it's really important then for that mindfulness and introspection always to be with you, so you can assess whether you're you're acting out of, you know, your anxiety, or whether you're, you know, being, I don't know how to say it, but being responsible with your anxiety.
Yeah, so one, are we being reactive? So being reactive is just like that panic. No, don't want it. But then, you know, like Angela, like you were saying, you just have to, you're living with it and it's continuous. And so then instead of being reactive, then you can use it. And I suppose that's being responsible. And then in the end, it can become a superpower. It can be really, really strong. And I mean, it's funny with stress, you know, people think, oh, it's a stressful job or it's a stressful situation, I can't wait to leave. But it's not actually, the stress is in us. It's not in the job. We can bring a mind at ease to it, even in really high powered things. So I've been watching the, it's one of the engineering shows called Mega Structures. And so these huge engineering feats, and the top engineer guy, and they're always, usually a guy, really calm, really chilled, really even. And why? Because they've had to be to hold the whole thing and the stress and the enormity and the millions of dollars and the millions of lives, and it all rests on them. So they have to be that broad and that calm to hold it all. So then let's hope that it's like transferable to family life.
That's the hope.
Yeah, it's funny. It's like, remember a couple of classes ago where Venerable Gyatso, you know, I read this thing where he said the thing is to not try and get rid of problems. You know, that's part of that panicking, not trying to get rid of the problems, to just recognize we're just going to have problems, and actually we can use problems. We can really benefit. We can become better, amazing human beings from having problems. So that's this really radical U-turn that we do in our mind, to stop wanting to get rid of the problems. And so then from that, then we'll be able to develop fortitude. We'll be able to develop a natural ease in situations, hone our skills, so our anxiety actually becomes analysis. Okay, well, thank you for staying on and for your input and questions. Mm-hmm.